As I looked at this passage, I thought the first half of it is actually quite challenging. The second half of it is also challenging, but maybe slightly easier to take. And that might be reflected in the sermon this morning as well. The first half might be slightly challenging, and the second half, we might be able to take that a little bit easier. So we'll see how we go this morning. It's great to be back after a couple of Sundays away, enjoying some sunshine in Greece with Esther and Megan and my parents. I won't go through all of our holiday snaps, but I thought I'd give you two of them. Megan was deciding to learn some new tricks, sitting up and holding an umbrella. She needed that above her pram because it was so hot. And that's just a nice one of us on Megan's first boat ride. And so I thought you'd like to see that as well. I'm someone who likes to relax on holiday. I'm not a big sunbather, but my favourite thing to do is just to sit overlooking the beach or the sea with a drink in my hand, watching the world go by. And I managed to do a fair bit of that on holiday, so I was happy. But I was there with my dad and with Esther, who aren't so able to sit still for very long. They can manage about 5 minutes before their legs start getting twitchy and they have to go and see some historic site somewhere. But we managed to find quite a good balance, which was helped by the fact that the history in this area was stuff that really did interest me and excite me, because it's all about church history. It's our history. We were staying in a city called Thessaloniki, which is where Paul set up one of the first churches and where we get the letter of Thessalonians from in the New Testament. Probably the most interesting site that we visited here was a monastery where Paul stayed on one of his visits to the city. And we actually saw a room where they think Paul would have slept when he was there, which was quite exciting. But actually, perhaps more interesting and more exciting for me was a day trip that we did to Philippi, which was about 2 hours away. And this is another place where Paul visited and shared the good news about Jesus and planted a church. And whilst this city is now an ancient ruin, as you can see from some of these pictures, we could see the different places that are described in the book of Acts about Paul's visit to Philippi. In Acts chapter 16, we're told that Paul and Silas, having started preaching in the city and having healed a slave girl, were dragged before the magistrates. They were put on trial, severely flogged, and placed in jail with their hands and their feet in stocks. And this was the jail where they sang praises to God, and there was a great earthquake that shook the foundations of the prison, and their chains broke off and the doors flung open. But instead of running away, they stayed and they shared their faith with the jailer, and he came to know Jesus and was baptized. Seeing this ancient site really brought this story to life for me. We were able to see the city square, which is the picture on the right-hand side, where Paul and Silas were dragged and where they were flogged. And just in that area, there was a platform where they think the magistrates would have stood as they judged him and tried him. And the prison on the left-hand side as well, we saw where they believed that Paul and Silas were held when they were there, and where they sang and the gates broke open and all that kind of stuff that happened there. But one of the things that really struck me as I walked around this boiling hot site and imagined what it must have been like for Paul is just how brutal his journey was. Paul had travelled here from Jerusalem. He risked his life to bring other people to Jesus and to plant churches. He was flogged and imprisoned, not just in Philippi, but in many of the other places that he visited as well. And this wasn't just what faced Paul, but this was what faced all of the apostles that were sent out to share their faith in Jesus with the world. Looking at Peter, who wrote the letter that we're studying today, he spent the final years of his life imprisoned by Emperor Nero in Rome before we think he was crucified eventually, and he was actually crucified upside down because he didn't want to be crucified in the same way as Jesus. And so these stories of the apostles like Peter and Paul are actually a real challenge to our faith and our willingness to give our all in serving God. The question that came to my mind as I wandered around Philippi earlier this week was, what was it that drove these apostles to do what they did? What was the motivating factor that led them to have this willingness to leave their homes, to travel the world, to face torture, imprisonment, and death in order to make Jesus known? It must have been something incredible that pushed them and motivated them to do that. I spent some time thinking and racking my brains of what was it that drove them. And the only motivation I can think of is love. As Jesus said, greater love has no one than this, that they would lay down their life for their friends. I think it was their love of the Lord Jesus, their desire to make him known and to share all the amazing things that they saw him do, that ultimately motivated them. The passage we're looking at today, written by Peter, is given the title in the NIV Bible, Living for God. Another way that we might put that is righteous living. This fits with our verse for the year about being oaks of righteousness, planted by the Lord for the display of his splendor. And we're using this letter of Peter to help us consider how we might live righteous lives that display the splendor of God. And the question I believe this passage poses to us is also one of motivation. What is our motivation for righteous living? What drives us to live our lives for God? The first few verses of this chapter, as I said, are perhaps the most challenging because they tell us something of the reality of what we should expect as we live out our lives as Christians. This is what it says. Since Christ suffered in his body, arm yourselves also with the same attitude, because whoever suffers in the body is done with sin. As a result, they do not live the rest of their earthly lives for evil human desires, but rather for the will of God. In order to live righteous lives, this passage says we should adopt an attitude of suffering, just like Jesus did. Living lives that are countercultural, that are different to the society around us, will lead us into suffering. That might be suffering like Peter and Paul, who were persecuted because of their beliefs and actions, as many Christians around the world are today. Or it might be an inner suffering, an inner struggle, as we seek to battle the earthly desires, our selfish, our own desires that are going on within us, and focus on God and his will instead of our own. The passage goes on to list some of the earthly desires that should be left behind. It says, for you have spent enough time in the past doing what pagans choose to do, living in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and detestable idolatry. It's saying, leave these things behind you and live for God. But leaving these things behind us can be really tough and can lead us to feel like we're suffering. Growing up, I went to a church which was quite strongly evangelical, where quite a lot of the focus of what we were taught, particularly in the youth group I was in, was about behaving in the right way as followers of Jesus. And these can be some of the really challenging things to hear as we explore our faith. As I said, in my youth group, we spent quite a lot of time focusing on topics that I think everyone struggles with, but perhaps teenagers more, like sex and drinking and stuff like that. That tended to be the common theme of a lot of the studies that we were doing, which wasn't always a positive thing. But it has shaped some of my faith and the values that I hold as a Christian. I'm still a firm believer that God has created sex for marriage and that this is the best place for it. But this is a view that has become increasingly unpopular in churches, as living together before marriage has become increasingly normal in our culture. Similarly, many churches once had a stronger stance on alcohol consumption. I speak as someone who likes a drink, so don't feel condemned by what I'm saying, and I'm guilty of overindulging on quite a few occasions. But again, Christians seem to have loosened their stance on drinking. As a culture of drinking to excess has grown in the society around us, it's become more normal. And we say, oh, well, maybe it is okay. These are just two of many examples of how Christians have become increasingly relaxed in how we live in order to conform to the culture around us. And it's not just about the way we live, but perhaps also in some of the theology and values that we hold in terms of what we believe as well, where we've become more relaxed in what we believe in order to suit the culture around us. This passage clearly says that living for God involves living differently, leaving our human desires behind us in order to live for Christ. This is something that's echoed by Paul as well as Peter, who tells us in Ephesians to not conform to the pattern of this world, but to be transformed. This struggle to live counterculturally is clear in verse 4 of the passage, which says, they, talking about the pagan culture around them, are surprised that you do not join them in reckless, wild living, and they heap abuse on you. This made me think about the reaction we might get as followers of Jesus from the culture around us if we chose to live counterculturally. What reaction would we get if we chose not to live with someone until we married them? What reaction would we get if we said no to the third drink offered to us on a night out and instead asked for a lemonade? What reaction would we get if we didn't join in the gossip at work or the banter in our sports team? All these things might surprise the people around us and may lead them to criticize us and even abuse us. I have friends who were really shocked that I didn't live with Esther until we were married. Peter is clear in his message. Living for God is sacrificial. It involves living countercultural lives and refraining from some of our human desires. But whilst this passage points out the importance of being different and the challenge of refraining from sin, it doesn't place this as the main motivation for righteous living, for living for God. So let's get into the bit of the passage that might be slightly easier to hear. Our motivation in living for God shouldn't be a desire to be perfect and holy. I expect that when I mentioned the words righteous living, many of us here would have thought straight away about the need to live without sin, to be good and well-behaved Christians. But actually, I don't think God wants us to be good. I think God wants us to be real in the way that we're living our lives. I don't think he wants us to be really legalistic and fearful about sin. But he wants us to be real with him. He wants us to be the people that he's created us to be, with our gifts and abilities, but also our imperfections as well. So if what I've just said felt challenging, let's find some hope in that as well. I've met many Christians who live out a faith that is based on following rules. And generally this comes from one of two places. One driver for following the rules as Christians is fear. Some people fear what might happen if they don't live the perfect Christian life. Will God judge them? Might they go to hell? Might they not be rewarded as much in heaven? My response to that would be to point out what Jesus has already done for us. In Romans 5, verse 8, it says that God showed his love to us in this way, that whilst we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Jesus has already dealt with our sin. We're saved by grace and not by anything we can do. So let's not worry too much about the fact that we sin and instead receive God's grace and his forgiveness and his love. Be real, be the people that he's created us to be, and allow God to use both your qualities and your imperfections. Another driver, I think, that leads people to live a rules-based faith is their own self-righteousness. This is a faith based around creating a perfect image of themselves. But their actual motivation, rather than loving and serving God, is to feel in control, to feel good about themselves, or to create an image of being the perfect Christian to other people. And this is a bit like the Pharisees in the Bible, who radically followed the law and kept everyone else to it, but were really motivated by self-righteousness, power, and control. Yesterday I read a tweet posted by Pope Francis, which I found quite helpful in understanding this point about self-righteousness. And it linked in with the theme of talking about Peter and Paul, which I've been talking about this morning. He said, "Saint Peter and Paul were transparent before God. Throughout life, they preserved this humility to the very end. Both understood that holiness does not consist of exalting, but humbling oneself before God. God doesn't want us to live out our faith in either of these ways. He doesn't want our motivation for living for him to be a fear of him judging us. And he also doesn't want our motivation to be our own self-righteousness, our own need for power and recognition. Rather, the right motivation for righteous living, living our lives for God, is found a couple of verses later in verse 8. And this is what I think we should be basing our Christian walk around. Above all, love each other deeply, because love covers a multitude of sins. Our motivation for living for God should be the same motivation that the apostles had as they traveled the world and shared their faith. It should be driven by love. Jesus stressed love as the most important aspect of the Christian life. He gave us a commandment that goes above any other commandment or law written in the Bible. We can find that in Matthew chapter 22, where Jesus is asked, "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment of all?" And he said, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All of the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments." This was quite a controversial teaching at the time when Jesus was speaking, because all of the other religious leaders and teachers were majoring on the importance of following the law found in the Jewish scriptures, following the rules. This was a society where people were outcast and punished if they lived outside of the Jewish law. One of these laws was not working on the Sabbath. Jesus was criticized by the Pharisees for healing on the Sabbath and for picking corn to feed his disciples. His actions of healing and feeding others were based on love. He placed love above the importance of blindly following rules. Jesus placed these two commandments above all others. He didn't tell us to stop trying to live good lives and to ignore the Old Testament laws. The Ten Commandments have a lot of worth in them. Do not kill. Do not commit adultery. Do not worship any other god. These are all still very valid. But instead, Jesus hung all these other laws and teachings on these two primary commandments. Make these your motivations for righteous living. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And love your neighbor. If we do that, that will naturally lead us to do the other laws of not killing, not committing adultery, not worshipping any other god, and any others that you can think of. Verse 8 of 1 Peter 4 says, above all else, love. Above the teaching he has just given on sacrificial living and suffering for our faith and living a sin-free, countercultural life, is this teaching. Above all else, love each other deeply. This is more important than following the rules. He goes on to say that love covers a multitude of sins. Our motivation for living for God shouldn't be trying to manage sin. The love of Jesus has already covered that. Our focus should be having a loving relationship with Jesus, allowing that relationship to affect the choices that we make in our everyday lives. A life that is shaped by a love of God and a love of each other will naturally lead us to live more righteously. We might find ourselves saying, "No, I'm not going to join in the gossip at work." Not just because that's a rule, but because I know that that isn't loving. Instead, I'm going to be a friend to that person who's being slandered by other people. Living lives that are fueled by love influences a whole range of decisions and choices that we might make. With this as our lens, how do we spend our money in a way that places others first? How do we conduct our friendships and relationships with loved ones? How do we spend our free time? Who do we socialize with? How do we treat strangers and those in need? Who should I vote for in an upcoming election? What values do I teach my children? The crux of this teaching by Peter, and the other passages as well from Jesus and from Paul, is that God's desire is to live in a relationship with us. He wants us to follow him for the right reasons, with the right motivation. He doesn't want a bunch of rule-following Christians who live in fear of God as a judge. And he doesn't want self-righteous Christians who make faith more about themselves than about the God that they're following. He wants followers who are fueled by their love for him and their passion to make his love known to the world. God wants Christians who are real instead of religious and who prioritize relationship over rules. As a parent, do I want my daughter to behave well and to make the right choices in life? Yes, definitely I do. Do I want her to make those decisions out of a fear of me punishing her? Or do I want her to make those decisions out of the love and respect she has for me, the love she has for God, and the love that she has for the world around her? I think those are the values that I would rather instill in my daughter. This is like God. He's a loving father and a friend who wants to live in a relationship with us and who calls us to live lives that reflect that love. He wants us to stop trying to be perfect Christians and be real instead of being religious. Not following the rules just because we have to, but trying our best to love him and serve him and love the people around us. And then actually the other things will fall into place. And so what does righteous living based on love actually look like? This passage gives us a few suggestions. The first is that we should practice hospitality. Verse 9 tells us to offer hospitality to each other without grumbling. I think our understanding of hospitality is perhaps slightly different to Peter's understanding of hospitality. We might think of it as having someone to stay for a night or cooking someone a meal. But I think Peter actually had a more radical understanding of hospitality that offers us a much greater challenge and might lead to more grumbling. His model of hospitality would have been based on the teaching that he gave to the very first church that he planted in Jerusalem. And we can read this at the end of Acts chapter 2. I don't have it up there. It says, all the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. The hospitality that Peter talks about is one in which people are willing and ready to share everything that they have. And you can see why this leads to grumbling. In that passage, it says that they sold their property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Who here would be ready and willing to sell their property and their possessions to give to anyone who had need? I think I'd struggle with that challenge. How might radical hospitality be a way of reflecting God's love today in our lives and in our world? One of the events that we've put on as a church that made quite an impact in our community and was probably one of the most shared things on social media was the Christmas Day dinner that took place at the Hub the last couple of years. I think the reason so many people shared this and offered to help in some way and talked about it was because they recognized the sacrifice that was being made by the few people who were leading it in order to show God's love to other people. I think many of us would grumble if we had to give up our Christmas Day, including me. But it's this kind of radical, sacrificial hospitality that makes a difference and reflects the love of God. And this is just one example. There are other things that could be done. The passage then tells us in verse 10 to serve each other using the gifts that you have been given. Verse 10 says, each of you should use whatever gift you have received to serve others as faithful stewards of God's grace in its various forms. And so in order to live our lives for God based on love, we should be able to recognize and use the gifts that God's given us in order to serve other people. This is talking about spiritual and practical gifts that we all have. This could range from praying for someone for healing, to sharing our faith with a friend, to offering a word of encouragement, to helping an elderly neighbor with her shopping. We should use whatever gifts and abilities and resources we've been given in order to love and to serve our neighbor. Over the past couple of years, one of the things I've really enjoyed doing here in Ruddington has been coaching hockey at the school for an hour on a Thursday afternoon. I don't count this as part of my job as minister, and there isn't really a faith element to it in terms of teaching the children about God. But actually, God has given me a passion for sport and the ability to share it and teach it to other people. And by doing this, it's led me closer in relationships with the teachers and students and parents at the school that I wouldn't have had, I wouldn't have made these relationships otherwise. And this gives me the opportunity then to bring God's love into that environment. What gifts and abilities, spiritual and practical, has God given to you that you could use to serve others? And as the passage says, to be a faithful steward of God's grace. The third bit of advice for living righteous lives based on love comes in verse 11. If anyone speaks, they should do so as one who speaks the very words of God. This can be taken in two ways. One is telling us to watch our mouths and be careful what we say. There are quite a few passages out there that talk about us being careful in the way that we speak. Proverbs, which is a book of wisdom sayings in the Old Testament, has at least four verses that talk about taming the tongue. In chapter 21, it says, those who guard their mouths and their tongues keep themselves from calamity. Another verse says, the tongue has the power of life and death, and those who love it will eat its fruit. And then another passage James chapter 3. Talks about minding our mouth. It says, no human being can tame the tongue. It's a restless evil full of deadly poison. With the tongue we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse human beings who have been made in God's likeness. This verse doesn't necessarily offer much hope in terms of taming the tongue, but it does show how dangerous our words can be and how important it is that we consider what we say and make our words filled with love. This verse can also be read in another way. It tells us that if we speak, we should speak the very words of God. This offers a positive use of our voices, to give God praise, to exalt him, to share his good news with other people, to encourage others, to share words of love and joy and hope with those around us. Before we speak, we should seek God and ask what he wants us to say into particular situations. I often find that when I do ask God to guide my lips, particularly if I'm facing a difficult conversation with someone, that he normally does that. Verse 11 also tells us that when we serve others, we should do it in God's strength and not our own. If anyone serves, they should do so with the strength that God provides. Often in my life, when God has led me to do something or serve him in some way, I felt ill-equipped, that I'm not good enough, that I don't have everything that I need. And I expect that this is the way that the apostles felt as well when God gave them this challenge of sharing the gospel with the world. But then they were filled with the Spirit on Pentecost, and God gave them everything that they needed. If God leads us to serve him in a particular way, he'll also provide the strength and the resources and abilities that we need. I believe that God also has the ability to use our mistakes and turn them for his glory. And then finally, again in verse 11, Peter summarizes his instructions by saying, adopt these principles so that in all things God may be praised. Living righteous lives, living our lives for God, fueled by love, is our greatest act of praise and worship to God. If we want to worship God, then we can do that best through living our lives out of his love. The word worship means to give worth. And so faithful lives driven by love always point back to God, giving all the worth and all the glory to him and not to ourselves. And so to bring together everything that I've shared this morning, this passage is all about living for God with the right motivation. Living as oaks of righteousness is not about being perfect and holy. It's not about being sin-free, trying to achieve God's approval, living in fear or with self-righteousness. Rather, we live as oaks of righteousness when our words and our actions come from a place of love, a love of God and a love of other people. Our relationship with God should overflow into our actions and our love towards other people. Righteousness and holiness will follow as we seek to love and serve God. And this was the passage that came to mind that I wanted to finish with this morning. Jesus said, "Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and everything else will follow." Don't seek our own righteousness, seek his righteousness, and everything else will follow. And that's Peter's challenge to us in this passage, to seek God, to seek his love, to seek his kingdom and his righteousness, and let him take care of the rest.